Okay, good morning. I'm going to shift gears. I'm not going to talk about corn, soybeans, wheat, rice, cotton, nothing. None of that. I'm going to talk about specialty crops. Actually, I moved from the Corn Belt at Michigan State into the Pacific Northwest and learned that corn and soybeans didn't matter there. So specialty crops do, and there's a lot of interest in precision agriculture and what it can do, and I'm going to try to give you an overview of some of the things that are there. But I do have, where's the advance on here? Just this? There we go. I'm going to give you an overview of specialty crops. How many here work in specialty crops? How many don't know if they work in specialty crops? That'd be an even better question. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what they are, and I'm going to talk about what the aspects of specialty crops that really lend themselves to precision agriculture, vice versa, whichever way you like to look at it. Give you a couple of case studies, and then talk a little bit about looking forward. So the USDA, of course, always has an official definition of everything, but this one's particularly interesting because specialty crops were not part of the Farm Bill in terms of funding research until about 5 years ago. And so when they started to fund specialty crop research initiative, they had to get clear what it is. And so it's fruits and vegetables, tree nuts, dried fruits, horticulture, and nursery crops, including floriculture. If you look at how many crops that is, the official listing is over 300, and that's if you don't start to segment the different categories. And you can think on a global basis how many there are. So the first thing I have to tell you is I can't do this subject justice in a given talk. Right, it's just impossible, and there's so much diversity and so much variety and so many cultural aspects associated with specialty crops, it's impossible to get there. So I'm going to go by the example route. So this is a forest slide. This is what I live in. Okay, you don't see a corn plant. You see center pivots in an 8-inch rainfall zone. You see grapes that are produced, actually when I first got out there, I realized that everything we were taught in school in terms of producing wine grapes was exactly opposite to how they manage them. They want to stress the devil out of them, prune them, cut them back, reduce their growth, control them, and it's quite different. If you ever get up to the Chelan area, one of the most pretty places on the planet, and the potatoes are, nobody knows that everyone thinks of potatoes as Idaho. Actually, Washington State is the produces two to three times the yield and has the highest quality potato production in the United States, far exceeding anything in Idaho. So next time you talk to your Idaho potato guys, tell them that they're not quite there. So let's talk about specialty crops. And I'm going to just kind of go through this quickly, but high value. Anybody have an idea what a really good sweet cherry crop is worth? It's about $30,000 to $40,000 an acre gross returns. Big numbers. Wine grapes, maybe $3,000 or $4,000, but it's the added value of the wine grape because there's about $1 worth of grapes in a wine bottle, but you're paying $30, $40 depending on how you perceive the quality. A lot of the specialty crops have input optimums, okay, and that's really important because what's precision ag about? It's about getting it right, right? And so if I have an optimum, that means that if I go too high or too low, I fail. And so they lend themselves specifically to that, and they have a lot of inputs. So when we start talking about specialty crops, we start talking about quality and nutritional value and all these sorts of things. We're talking about lots of micronutrients and lots of inputs that you don't think about when you grow a corn crop. High pest and disease pressure because of where they're grown, but also because they're a luxurious source of food for insects and other things. As a result, they tend to be a large user of crop protection chemicals. And I had a slide in here earlier, but I took it out because I've got lots of slides. But when you start looking at the active pound per acre for some of the specialty crops, they're quite enormous. And so they're a high user, and it's because of the high pest and disease pressure. They're often irrigated. You'll see things like potatoes. 95% of the potatoes in the United States are irrigated. If you come to our area, all the crops are, nothing grows in our area at 8-inch or annual rainfall without water in it. So if it's green, it's being irrigated. Dependence on human labor. We saw mechanization in corn and other things. We have large labor inputs into our crops, and I'll give you some examples of where that becomes very important in terms of precision agriculture and automation. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about scales across the globe. It's not just about high-value crops in the U.S. It scales across the globe. Sensitive to weather, and by that I mean, let me give you an example. Cherries and apples have a 3 or 4 day window for pollination. And if the temperature or the weather conditions are not good for bees to fly, they don't fly. And pollination has to happen in a short window of period. So they're very, very sensitive to environmental conditions. Because of their high intensity, use a lot of water, use a lot of pesticides, they're often associated with considerable environmental impacts. They're important to human health. Eat this, not that. I was just at a meeting in D.C. where the list of eat this and was, you know, don't eat red meat, don't eat processed grains, don't eat potatoes, by the way, is on the don't eat list right now. I mean, we know that it's being taken out of the food programs in schools. Very, very controversial, but that's what's happening. On the eat this side is all the fruits and vegetables and nuts and everything I showed you. But a comment was made at this meeting that said if the American public went to eat this and not that, we have a 3 day food supply. In other words, all the things we can talk about can't even come close to feeding the world population or the U.S. population where we do that right now. And if any of you have had a melon lately or some spinach or anything like that, you realize that traceability is very important. Usually we think of traceability in terms of disease pressure, or I mean contamination of something. But actually traceability is becoming very, very important to the consumer in terms of I want what I want, and if you've got it, I want to find it. You know, so it's got a real positive aspect to it as well. So if I were to conclude right now, I'd say there's an enormous potential for precision agriculture in specialty crops across the globe. And I always wonder what would have happened if precision ag had started in specialty crops and not in grain crops. What we would learn and what we would know, because the problems are quite different. Okay, so I'm going to try to go through this quickly. I got a lot of stuff, and so I know Raj, he will not let me go over. So I'm going to fly here a little bit. But I want to talk about a complete system change from genetics to the table in order to get to precision agriculture. So you can't go in and say, I'm just going to tweak what we're already doing like we tried to do in corn. I put fertilizers on, I'm going to tweak it. We may have to redesign the entire system. I'll talk a little bit about wine grapes. Optimization is critical. In other words, I've got a very sharp optimization curve, and if I get off on either side of it, I fail. I don't get the crop that I'm looking for. I don't get the yield. I don't get the quality. I don't get the sugars in the grapes, all these kinds of things. Talk a bit about automation in the container industry. Anybody ever seen a nursery, fairly substantial nursery? You know, hundreds of thousands of plants that they're moving around. It's very interesting, and it has all kinds of opportunities for precision agriculture. I'm going to show you some automation. Labor is still, I'm going to show you a slide that Raj will tell you that came from a developing country. It came from 10 miles from my house in eastern Washington. Okay. Hand labor is still alive and well, and hand weeding and thinning in organic vegetable crops is alive and well, and it's extremely expensive, and it's the wrong way to go. And then traceability application in the apple nursery of Washington Department of Agriculture. Just a little example, but what it does, it has all these things have ramifications across the world. So sweet cherries. Sweet cherry fans here, anybody like them? They're wonderful. If you haven't had any from Washington State, you're missing out. Actually, we send all our best cherries to Taiwan and Japan. So you need to get our best ones over there. High-value crop, gross returns tens of thousands of dollars on a good year. I mean, they can have bad years as well. Huge input costs, 60% of which are associated with the cost. 60% of the cost of production is associated with labor, primarily harvest. All right, cherries are hand-picked by the cluster. Growers get paid primarily on size and color. So when you go to the market, you're looking for big cherries that have the right color, depending on the variety. And everything else doesn't much matter as long as there's not a deformation in the crop or it's been chewed up by an insect. Okay. The cherry tree on the left is probably 50 years old. The one on the right is what's called the central leader. Most of our cherry trees in Washington State look like the one on the right. individual tree. Don't remember the exact population per acre. Both of these are about 150 feet apart. Okay. If you were in charge of designing a precision ag system for that, how would you feel? Not so good. That does not lend itself to a lot of things, and that we'd like to do in precision management. Okay, so late 1990s, a guy by the name of Don Peterson out of the USDA research group in Virginia developed a cherry harvester, and he showed that you could he had an articulating arm, hit the tree, cherries would drop on a catch frame, and they would put it into bins and they'd be on their way, and they could reduce harvest labor by 80%. Big deal. Problem is they produce a stem-free cherry. Anybody bought a stem-free cherry in the marketplace? No. You think of a cherry has a stem on it. So, we got some serious issues with cherries. We want to go to not only mechanization, but automation and precision techniques where we reduce the cost of production. I could talk about numbers about the average spray of a fruit tree in the state of Washington, there's 18 sprays per year. Depending on the year, it could go higher or lower. So precision ag is very, very important. Tough to do. So just a little knowledge. There's an abscission zone at the stem, and if I apply enough energy to the tree, I can get it to break free, okay? And that's the abscission zone. And it turns out that varieties of cherries are, some are self-abscising, some can be induced with a growth hormone, and some are resistant. You can't get them off. It won't happen. So there's a lot of genetics here, and there is an unknown market for cherries. If you walked into a grocery store today and saw a bowl of stem-free cherries and a bowl of stem cherries, which would you pick? And I think you'd be suspicious of the stem-free ones. Because, well, okay. You want stem-free. Okay, well, there's some reasons why you'd want them. But anyway, it's an interesting, I'm trying to lay out the problem of why you got to change the whole system. So, my colleague, Matt Whitey, is also a co-author on a paper here. A couple years ago, we sat down and said, SCRA's got a great project. We need to go from the genetics to the table. We have a funded project called the Total Systems Approach to Developing a Sustainable Stem-Free Sweet Cherry Production, Processing, and Marketing System. From beginning to end, okay? And so it involves breeding and genomics. They're doing fundamental work understanding through genomics what are the genes involved in abscission. So that's how fundamental this project's getting. To plant propagation, to how you process and pack this stuff, how you market it, what the distribution is. By the way, that marketing and distribution, that's controlled by a handful of companies that distribute cherries, and they don't want to see a stem-free cherry because they don't know what the market looks like. They haven't got your email yet that you want that. Okay? And then there's consumer and retail aspects of, you know, will the customer buy it? Okay, so top left tree, a central leader tree, that's traditional. The bottom left is a new diagram. This is called an upright fruiting offshoot, a UFO. Okay? So think in terms of creating a plane of fruit in the field, very close row spacings, all the fruit's vertical, and it's easy to manage, easy to apply crop protection chemicals, easy to manage, easy for airflow, high light absorption, and that's where they're going, all right? And we're about the third year of getting these in. I'll show you a little bit of data. What do you think the growers are thinking? I'm planting 9-foot rows with 2-foot spacings between plants compared to, you know, so a couple thousand plants per acre versus a couple hundred or 300 or 400 plants per acre. Everything's different. So it's a whole change in the entire system. So everything needs to change here from how we plant them, the genes, the genetics, the varieties, to how we put them up, and then how we manage them. Okay, so we have five-year-old, these are some of the early things that are out there, but 5-year-old Titan, and they're all grown on rootstock. This is a Gisela 6 rootstock. The central leader system for the same age, 15 tons per hectare, and the UFO, 25 tons per hectare. And actually, the growers that have already started to put these in are already getting fruit off the second year, and they're seeing the same numbers show up. So my point is this. I can't talk about all the possible specialty crops that are out there. But if we're going to get to the next level, we got to change the entire system over and we think this is working. Okay, so we can start to build machines that go over the row. You can start building mechanical pruning systems instead of chemical pruning or hand labor pruning. We can do mechanical pruning, precision thinning without chemicals, where they're using chemicals right now, and build new machinery. And this can be, I think this can be scaled in any way. Okay, grapes. If this is a typical picture of wine grapes, you saw there's a very thin canopy. Okay, beautiful grapes exposed to the sun. I'm trying to get what's bricks or sugar contents about 27%, because you know sugar equals alcohol, right? In the fermentation process. I want to stress these. I don't want them to grow. If you grow a grape plant in your backyard, if you don't manage it, it's the worst weed you're ever going to have in your life. It wants to grow in every direction. To put a lot of management into keeping this right. And to get it right, even when you're doing it at this level, you're trying to get all these optimals to all fit in the same package. It's difficult. So this is a high-end vineyard along the Columbia River in Washington State. And these guys produce $20, $30, $40 bottles of wine. But this particular vineyard, they weren't getting the quality out of it, so they were packing it off in the $7, $8, $9 bottle per wine. You'll see that we started working with them on imagery and found that just through a canopy density, through an NDVI, we could relate that there was significant differences out there in the field. And there's other ways of getting this even by hand. And the point is that they are now doing selective harvest, and part of the field's going in the $25 bottle of wine, and part of it's going into the $7 bottle of wine, and there's a difference. Okay. This is one of the pests in wine grapes. This particular cutworm, what it does is it grows up the trunk, and then at night feeds on the buds. All right, and they used to use some nasty chemicals to kill this thing. What they found was is that if they could just keep it from climbing the trunks or the post, they could solve the problem. Wine grapes, they would go off and feed on something else. And so Doug Welsh, our entomologist, figured that out and found out that barriers on the trunk or on the post would take care of this. This is what they used to do. And on the left-hand side is now what they do most, which is berm sprays. Instead of blowing it all over, they're spraying it on the berm, and so it inhibits the cutworm from going in there, all right? There's a company that builds a little trigger system, a barrier application, and then what we were looking at was, could you just get it right down to the minimum amount of material? And one of the reasons for doing this is there's some organic applications that could go on here instead of the insecticides, some very cool things that cutworm doesn't like, but they're expensive, and they're expensive to apply. So if I can get it to the right, to the targeted application, then I could start using organics. I could start doing a whole lot of things that are very meaningful and easy to use and effective. So we had some engineers, worked with them, built a truck detection system based on a scanning laser, and it works extremely well. You can mount the laser with multiple sprayers, and you can put them on something as simple as a little trailer. The trailer costs $750 off the shelf. Put a couple sprayers on there, not really terribly expensive. What's expensive is the scanning laser, not because it can't be built cheaper, but because there's not many people that build them. This system has worked very well. We put it on a over-the-row system. We've also put it on its trailer, and it's worked extremely well, and that can be scaled very small to very large. Okay, here's the container industry. $17 billion. If your PhD degree doesn't work out, I suggest that you go get 10 acres and start containerizing plants. It's pretty good. You have one problem, and that is that you have workers that have to move the plants and do something to them on a regular basis. So if you notice in the big picture, all the pots are close together. Well, as that plant starts to grow up, they got to spread them up for airflow and room to grow, and also to prevent diseases and so forth. All right. So the biggest challenge on the horizon with nursery production is labor, and this is escalating. It's a problem, and you see this is the publication by the Department of Agriculture in California. Got 5 minutes? Okay. All right. So robots for agriculture. This is a company called Harvest Automation. I think it's going to be the first robot that's going to be allowed into agriculture unmanned. And if I can do this, I got to say okay here. Okay. These are very small. They're costly right now, but the technology that's driving them is not that costly. And so it automatically goes over, picks up the pot, and respaces them with no human labor. Okay, get the idea? I don't want to go too long on this because I've only got 5 minutes. So kind of interesting, all right? So I got to go down one more. All right, so this is their second device. This stuff's all going to be released about the 1st of January. So what I want to do is have the robot take that off and put it in a little container, have it do everything, apply fertilizers, check it for bugs, see if it's infected with a virus, and prune it, and that in the middle of moving. So now I lost it. How did I lose it? How do I go back? All right. So the same idea, those robots are out there, but now I'm going to take it through a container, stop for a minute, fertilize it, check it for viruses, check it for bugs, prune it, and put it in the new spacing, right? And why I'm excited about this is that it's got a lot of potential for global applications in agriculture. And the company's called Harvest Automation, and I'm on their board of directors, actually. Okay. All right, they're currently doing other things, material handling robots that work in unstructured environments. They're going to get involved in precision ag shortly, and they're looking for some partners. Okay. This is a scene about 15-20 miles from my house. We grow a fair number of organic crops in our area because we have very little rainfall, warm temperatures, but the cost of weed control and thinning organic vegetable crops is between $1,000 and $12,000 a hectare. And that sounds like you got to be kidding me, but that's real. And the problem is this. If you look at the inset on the right, these guys have high-tech, high-end precision cultivators, can get within an inch of the plant, and there's no inter-row weeds. But in the row, they have to go in there on hands and knees and either thin or pull the weeds. There are some technologies coming along here that are going to allow us to do that. And that little robot that I just showed you could conceivably go over one row with some vision systems and start picking the weeds out and leaving the crop. And I don't have much more than that, but actually parts of this is already done. Okay. If I got 1 minute. Okay. I'm not going to get to this. I want to show you is that there's some technologies being done, RFID tagging the trees in the nursery, because if you don't catch something in the nursery, it gets into the field and propagates. A company I helped connect to builds this for Washington Department of Agriculture, but this has tremendous applications globally because it has all kinds of features of taking pictures, coming back. I think it could be done on a smartphone, and I think it could be used on a global basis. So my concluding slide is this. What are the opportunities? Automation is huge. It's going to not only require engineering, it's going to require changes in genetics. Input optimization is very critical. It's something precision ag theoretically does very well. Tracking and traceability is going to be a requirement, not a luxury in specialty crops because of the direct consumption by humans. Sensor-based agriculture, which is beyond precision agriculture, it says all the things that we're talking about, instead of having 50 graduate students go out and poke holes, we're going to have sensors that do it. And we're not that far away from having that if we really want to go there. Got to have the decision supports. No one's talked about that, but if you ask people what's the problem we're missing, it's the decision support systems about what to do in the future. And monitoring control, I had a section in there pulled it. That is very big, and there's some very, very good things going on there as well. So if you come to Washington State, I recommend hiking Chinook Pass. I go there every year on my birthday, and it is one of the most beautiful places on the planet. Thank you very much.